2024. We're here in room 1150 at the Minnesota Senate Building, 12:30 p.m., and a quorum is present. Thank you for coming today. We're going to have an informational hearing. I hope it's of interest. The topic is nuclear energy. I want to start by acknowledging that the discussion is primarily about the technology. Our state's had nuclear power. Where we have cited it has been a source of controversy. We want to be considerate of those people that live by nuclear now, and as we have this discussion, to try to discuss the issues of siting alongside the technological issues, climate change being a key source. It's also worth noting that the Senate Energy Committee passed the advanced nuclear study unanimously this session. That is, every Democrat and every Republican on this committee voted for it. Having said that, informational hearing, and apologize for the late start. We stayed on the floor there a little longer than we planned. Our testifiers begin with Stephanie Weir. Ms. Weir, can you come forward, please? And then on deck, we'd have Tay Stevenson. Mr. Stevenson, you're welcome to come up front in the on-deck circle. Ms. Weir, thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could start, please, by giving your testimony, by introducing yourself and giving your testimony. Come on, Nick.
Thank you very much. My name is Stephanie Weir. I am the Stakeholder and Regulatory Strategy Manager with the Gateway for Accelerated Innovation in Nuclear, which we abbreviate as GAIN. Thank you very, very much.
Ms. Weir, you got to lean into the microphone and, yeah, exactly. Thank you.
My apologies, Chair. So thank you very, very much for having us here today. I want to start off by just saying that we are not here to advocate for nuclear energy in your state. That, of course, is your state's decision. We are absolutely here to talk about the technology, to look at what other states are doing in this space, and then also help ensure that everyone is able to have the information that they need in order to have the conversations that need to be had. I understand, too, that you've had briefings from GAIN before and other folks in the nuclear community. So I thought we would just jump right in and start with an update on some of the commercial projects that are going on right now. If I use an acronym or if I jump ahead too far, please stop me.
We'll be the first ones to stop you.
Excellent. Wonderful. So I'd like to first start with two of the advanced reactor demonstration projects, ARDP projects, that are going forward. There has been news in the last week and a half that is very interesting and a positive step for TerraPower. They have submitted their construction application permit or permit application with the NRC. That was submitted at the end of last month. This is a great step forward for this project. This is the project that is being hosted in Kemmer, Wyoming. Another to mention is the other ARDP project, which is the Dow X Energy collaboration down in Texas. That too is also moving forward. That project is of note because it is a instead of putting just electrons on the grid, this is an opportunity to combine nuclear power and energy generation with a commercial chemical manufacturing facility. There are a couple other notes to bring you up to date on. OPG is committing to 300 megawatts electric. And there's also OPG and TVA are combining to work on a project in near Clinch River. I would also note that there is a significant increase in the interest in extending the life of the existing nuclear facilities. Two or three years ago, we had approximately 19 reactors across the country that were interested in extending the license life. We're now up to 37 who have put forward their interest in extending the life of their license. My colleague Tay will talk about a couple of the other things that you had expressed interest in, but I'm just gonna go ahead and jump in and give a very short, brief description of the spent nuclear fuel topic that you'd asked about.
That's fine. Ms. Weir, I was just going to say, we sort of combined you and Mr. Stevenson's time together, so I'll leave it up to the two of you to split that. We were thinking 15 minutes total. I know that you both have compelling testimony, so I'm going to stop interrupting and just sort of put the blinkers on at about 7 or 8 minutes from now. Fair enough?
That sounds
okay.
Perfect. Thank you,
Fire away.
Thank you. So just a really quick high-level summary of what spent nuclear fuel is. So spent nuclear fuel is a ceramic pellet about the size of a gummy bear. And a number of these pellets are combined into, assembled into a metal rod, which is a fuel rod. Those fuel rods are then organized into assemblies. And these assemblies are what's loaded into the current light water reactor fleet. They spend about 6 years in the reactor producing electricity and heat. Then they spend about 5 years in a spent fuel pool, I'm tongue-tied today. This allows the reactor, the spent fuel to cool down thermally. This is not cooling down radioactively. They are then bundled together, put into a stainless steel canister, which is vacuumed out of all water. The air is removed out of it. The air is replaced with an inert gas so that we don't have rust or any issues with the canister. That stainless steel canister is then loaded into a concrete cask. The cask is either vertical or horizontal. They live on concrete pads at the existing reactor fleet, and that's where they sit right now. And they will remain there, just as advanced reactor fuel will remain on its site, assuming that those sites go forward, until DOE is ready to receive the fuel, the spent fuel. DOE is working right now using a consent-based siting process and to site one or more consolidated interim storage facilities for that spent nuclear fuel. This is interim storage. This is not the final repository. We're not talking about that right now. I'm not here to talk about the possibility of closing the fuel cycle, which is definitely a very important and conversation to be had, because there is a lot of energy still remaining in the spent nuclear fuel. The consent-based siting process is in its early phases. We are in what's called phase 1B right now, which is where we are, the Department of Energy and its contractors like myself. So just to be very clear, I don't speak for the Department of Energy, I speak for the program. But we are working with communities across the country to help ensure that communities have the information that they need in order to even begin the conversation with the federal government about the possibility of raising their hand to explore siting a consolidated interim storage facility in their community, in their state. And so in the next couple of years, in phase two of the process, there will be an opportunity for communities to come forward and raise their hand. This is not volunteering to host. This is volunteering to explore the possibility of what it could mean for the community. And right now, we are working to understand what is important to communities and what will be, what are the give and take that would need to happen in order to make it a project of this nature amenable to both sides of the party, both sides of the table. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weir. Members, let's hold questions for now, finish the testimony, and go ahead. Mr. Stevenson, welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourselves. I got you down for a few minutes. And again, then if you can both remain, we'll have member questions at the end of all the testifiers. Mr. Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Taylor Stevenson. I'm representing Envoy Public Labs, which is my company. We're a contractor for, among others, the GAIN program, as well as the consent-based siting program at INL. I am here from Brainerd, Minnesota, which was a great commute down, and I appreciate the time. I'm gonna cover policy. And just to be clear, I'm from 140 miles away, which gives me 100 miles spare to be considered an expert. Stephanie is from 1,188 miles away, which makes her, by my Brainerd High School math, 10 times the expert I am. So when you guys have questions, I'll definitely defer to Stephanie on a lot of this. Again, I'll just answer some of the policy pieces. Quickly, I know you guys want to talk about federal incentives going on right now. Frankly, this is a conversation that's happening in a number of states across the country. I'm going to just very quickly tell you that I'm going to have an 8-page handout available for all of you This was an hour webinar, so I'm not going to try to condense it down. I'm just simply going to say that there are a number of opportunities, and really what we should be paying attention to are two different types of opportunities. So when people ask about federal incentives, one of the things that we need to be looking at is project financing, right? And that's what's available right now from the federal government. The other thing that we need to be looking at are federal grant opportunities for, in particular, communities. These are capacity building or, in some cases, screening, planning type of grants. Right now, currently, there is an Energy Works grant that is available. That is available from the Department of Energy's Office of Fossil Energy and Carbon Management. Again, I'll have more information available after the hearing for those that are interested in that capacity planning grant. What I want to spend most of my time on is what's going on in terms of legislation in other states. Generally speaking, there are two main things that I think are germane to what's happening here in Minnesota. First, there are a number of states that are looking at feasibility studies, working groups, but generally speaking, these are states that want to better understand how advanced reactors can fit into their state. There have been 22 feasibility studies ordered in the last two calendar years across the country. Most of those, in fact, 12 of them have come from legislatures passing bills asking for the feasibility studies. I would note Michigan, Kentucky, and New Hampshire as studies that have been completed recently that are worth looking at and not doing a Me Too type of study if a feasibility study is something that is appropriate for the state of Minnesota. Additionally, 8 states this year have pending legislation for feasibility studies, just to give you a sense of the context of what's going on around the country. Also germane to Minnesota, there are nuclear moratoria or bans on new nuclear generation. 12 states currently have bans on new nuclear, including Minnesota. 2 of them, Hawaii and Rhode Island, have introduced legislation this year to lift those moratoria. Hawaii's is not and will not pass. Rhode Island's is still in session. 4 nuclear moratoria have been lifted since 2016. That's been in Wisconsin, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Montana. And 2 have been partially lifted in Illinois and Connecticut. Other general trends I wanted to note for you all. First, what we're starting to see is, as you can tell, it's been some early activity for the last couple of years. That activity is starting to build on itself in a number of states. What you're seeing first is nuclear's inclusion in clean energy programs, clean energy plans, or different incentive programs that already exist for other types of generation sources in other states. Michigan would be a good example, or more or less neighboring state. They had a 100% clean energy standard that was nuclear inclusive that they passed in the last legislative session. Coal to nuclear transition is also a major, major driving force in the energy conversation, generally speaking, across the country. I spend a lot of my times in coal communities out in the West, as well as on the East Coast in Appalachia. Of note, Stephanie mentioned the Kemmerer project, TerraPower's project in Kemmerer, Wyoming. I would also note GAIN studies in the coal to nuclear space in Arizona, Kentucky, and Montana, as well as a recently completed Maryland study about a coal to nuclear facility that's been the possibility of transitioning a coal facility to a nuclear facility. There's also interest in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Virginia. I think you guys get the picture. This is something that's happening in a number of states. And again, it's looking at nuclear as, among other things, an economic transition vehicle for communities. Part of that conversation, though, is reliability, and that's something that I'm sure this committee has discussed a lot. Here in the MISO region, we're now seasonally talking about reliability. This is not dissimilar to conversations that are going on in PJM in the Mid-Atlantic region, Texas and ERCOT out in the West. This is something where nuclear is being seen as a possibility for replacing baseload production and providing more reliable power while still keeping clean electrons on the grid. Similarly, the concept of baseload power is being discussed widely, and not necessarily specific to nuclear, but just the need for baseload power. PJM, in fact, has recently held hearings talking about the need for thermal load because of reliability concerns at the end of the decade. Couple quick other things. Workforce is another major legislative trend that we're seeing picking up across the country. Virginia and Nebraska have passed laws in different ways providing funding, and Michigan has this year introduced a law, two different laws, One that's aimed at retaining graduates in the state to work in nuclear or hydrogen fields. The other that is aimed more at the K-12 workforce, the K-12 age group and workforce development. Finally, I just want to note that, generally speaking, there have been 121 bills introduced in this session alone, which is more in the first quarter of 2024 than all of 2022 combined. So when you look at the legislative trends, more and more states are getting interested in our passing foundational legislation around advanced reactors. And in fact, 13 bills have already passed this year in 10 different states. So in terms of trying to crystallize what you've heard from me and Stephanie today, I think there are two main points about nuclear policy and nuclear development. One is that states and communities are waking up to what Stephanie said earlier about the Texas project. It's not just about electrons anymore. We're looking at decarbonizing in industrial and transportation spaces, which require thermal generation that's clean. And nuclear is one of the only technologies that can fit that bill. The other is that it's not just about the reactors, right? So in nuclear, you have economic opportunities on the front end of the fuel cycle and fuel fabrication. You have economic opportunities on the back end of the fuel cycle. You also have economic opportunities adjacent to the fuel cycle in terms of advanced manufacturing and other capabilities. So these are the conversations that are happening in a number of states right now, and I wanted to take a few moments to bring some of this information to my friends here in my home state.
Thank you, Mr. Stevenson. Thank you, Ms. Weir. Like I said, if you could hang around, we may have some questions from members. With that, we're going to go to Assistant Commissioner Lieb, and on deck would be Nikki Lato. And you can both come forward if you want. Assistant Commissioner, welcome back to the committee. Thank you for coming. If you could please introduce yourself and present your testimony. I had you down here for 5 minutes, 10 minutes or so. Does that sound right?
That's correct. Good afternoon, Chair, friends, members of the Senate Energy Committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Sydney Lieb, and I serve as the Assistant Commissioner of Regulatory Affairs at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm joined here today by Sergio Baye Rodriguez, the Minnesota Department of Commerce Legislative Assistant. And we got my slides up much faster than anticipated, so I don't have to filibuster here. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the current state of nuclear energy production in Minnesota and the technology and policy developments that are occurring in the nuclear energy space. First slide. To give a little bit of table setting and background on where we're at currently in the state with nuclear energy production here in Minnesota. In 2023, the state's energy mix included 21% of generation from nuclear energy. This share of generation has been relatively constant over time, and generation from nuclear energy represents about 40% of the state's clean energy production, zero-emitting resource right now. Nuclear energy in the state currently comes from two existing power plants that began operation in the 1970s and are licensed to continue operation into the 2030s and 40s. Both plants are owned and operated by Xcel. I'm sure the committee or the Senate knows well that those two plants are Prairie Island, which is two units with a capacity of about 1,000 megawatts combined, and Monticello with a capacity of about 670 megawatts at a single unit. Currently, Prairie Island has a license that expires in the 2030s, and Monticello's license was recently extended to allow that plant to operate until 2040. Next slide. The technology and development in nuclear energy is primarily focused on small modular reactors, SMRs. These units are less than 300 megawatts each, and there are currently upwards of 70 companies in the U.S. that are exploring this technology, with a handful of them, about 5 to 10, that are at the stage of working with the federal government to receive the regulatory approvals that are needed to move forward towards commercialization. The small modular reactors have the advantage of being a single design that can be produced in a repeatable way, similar to the way we think about the auto industry moving towards a single car that could be mass produced. There are 92 different plants operating in the U.S. right now, and each one of those plants is a bespoke design, which is largely one of the drivers for delays in permitting and regulatory approval for those plants, and also one of the barriers to reducing the costs. If every single plant is a completely unique, bespoke system, that takes more time to review. This is one of the major factor in cost overruns and our ability to drive costs down, which is why you're seeing a lot of the advanced technology development focused on these smaller, modular, repeatable reactors. SMRs have potential for mass production, leading to lower costs over time and the potential to speed up the permitting and regulatory approval processes. And this is why, again, we've seen that this is where we're focusing the technology, given that it has the opportunity to decrease costs, decrease regulatory approval times, and increase safety. However, there are also opportunities to standardize design of more conventional, larger reactors and achieve similar benefits. We're also seeing advances in coolant technology. Many of the existing reactors that we have in the U.S. are water-cooled, but there is research into alternatives for high-temperature molten salts and metals, and also helium, which will improve the efficiency and the safety of these reactors. And then we're also seeing advances in the fuel technology itself to improve safety and efficiency. Next slide. We've heard a lot about the drive to commercialization of these reactors, so I wanted to give a sense of the timeline. Various advanced reactor developers have announced domestic demonstration projects that will be operational later in this decade. Many developers are already engaging with the regulatory commission at the federal level to obtain the necessary regulatory requirements. We're closely following these demonstration projects, but there are still significant questions regarding timeline for implementation at scale and the viability of these emerging technologies. We also note that while there are benefits to the SMR design, these generators are fundamentally different from the existing nuclear generators that we have in this state and across the country. Given the smaller size of these units, it will be important to understand how they contribute to our generation mix as more distributed resources and how this will impact investment in new and utilization of existing transmission and distribution infrastructure. Next slide. To close, we were asked to talk about federal policy and the implication to costs of new nuclear investment. This was already, I think, talked about in a little bit of detail by the previous testifier, but at a high level, there's two different programs that are relevant here. One is the DOE's Loan Program Office, which is providing low-cost loans to new clean energy projects. And the other are the production tax credit and investment tax credits for nuclear energy generation, and those are in the IRA. All of these programs together have the potential to bring down the cost of energy from both conventional and advanced nuclear generation down to a level that would be competitive with other zero-emitting firm resources and also some conventional generation resources. Specifically, we're looking here at clean firm. These are resources that do not emit carbon that can be turned on and off at the discretion of the operator. So these are different from intermittent renewables, where if the renewable resource is not available, there's no generation. And these are a critical resource to maintain reliability as we move towards a lower carbon grid. As we think about these are typically looking at natural gas with CCUS, carbon sequestration and utilization and storage, hydrogen co-firing with low GHG hydrogen, long duration batteries, something that can store energy for 12, 24, 48 hours, geothermal, and nuclear. So as we're thinking about this, we know that carbon-free options for balancing intermittent renewables are limited, and no technology has yet come down to the cost curve that we need it to get to. We have utilities experimenting with long-duration storage and co-firing of low GHG hydrogen as a derivative in gas plants in the state. We also have an interest in CCS nuclear and bringing more Canadian hydro as possible options to provide clean firm generation. The storage study that we recently completed with Siemens suggested that the low-cost path for Minnesota will require clean firm resources with the ability to provide power beyond a typical 4 or 8 hour battery. In response to changes in federal policy, there's been a number of changes in state policy. Many of them were outlined by the previous testifier. And This is also a response to the advancements in SMR technology and the known need for clean, firm technology resources. Several states have revisited their stance on nuclear energy, particularly concerning lifting nuclear moratoriums. New York in 2023 repealed its moratorium on new nuclear power plants, opening the possibility for future nuclear energy projects in parts of the state. And in 2023, Illinois also, following legislative efforts, lifted its moratorium on new nuclear power plants. Thank you again for your time today. We'll be available for questions or follow-up as this conversation continues.
Thank you very much, Assistant Commissioner Lieb. And I would ask if you could hang around. We should have some member questions coming up. Ms. Lato, welcome to the committee. Thank you for your patience as we got going here. If you could, please introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you. So, hello? Can you hear me? Okay. Mr. Chair, members, on Peto Washte, Niki Lato Imakiapie, Mazawiya Imakiapie, Prairie Island Indian Community, Dama Taha. Good afternoon. My name is Niki Lato. My Dakota name is Mazawiya, which means Iron Woman. I'm a member of the Prairie Island Indian Community, and I'm also our federal government relations specialist. I'm here on behalf of the Tribal Council, who is traveling this week and not able to attend, but we thank you for the opportunity to testify before the committee today. My testimony on the nuclear moratorium is a topic that's very important to our tribe, especially due to our close proximity to the nuclear Xcel Energy's nuclear power plant, the Prairie Island nuclear generating plant. The Prairie Island Indian Community is a federally recognized tribe in Minnesota whose reservation is located on an island in the Mississippi River called Prairie Island. Our reservation sits less than 700 yards from the nuclear power plant and over 1,000 tons of nuclear waste generated from the plant. We are the closest community in the nation to a nuclear power plant and stored nuclear waste. As you may know, the Prairie Island nuclear plant went into operation in 1973, adjacent to our reservation. At the time, the tribe did not have the education or the resources to ask questions of the company or engage in the regulatory process or the legislature. So it was built without consultation with our community. In fact, a number of tribal members, including my uncle, worked on the construction of the plant, given the lack of economic opportunity at the time. The Prairie Island nuclear plant was put into operation with the idea that the federal government would construct a national repository for the nuclear waste. And as we all know, the site in Nevada, Yucca Mountain, which was designated by the federal government for nuclear waste. However, Yucca Mountain has never become viable despite tens of billions of dollars spent. So in 1994, Minnesota legislature authorized dry cask to be stored at Prairie Island. The tribe adamantly opposed and exhaustively opposed. I know this because my mother was on tribal council at the time. They adamantly and exhaustively opposed this, but it was passed despite our concerns. Tribal members have lived next to nuclear waste for 30 years and next to the generating plant for 50 years. There are generations of tribal members, including myself, who do not know our ancestral homeland without a nuclear plant or nuclear waste. As the original stewards of the land we're currently on, we support conservation efforts and the move toward clean energy. But we must also keep in mind that each energy policy decision comes with trade-offs. Each of these decisions affects the general public and the communities in which the generation resides. Unfortunately, Prairie Island has had a front row seat to the nation's failed nuclear storage policy because we don't know when or if the waste will ever be moved. But we do know if it is moved to a repository at some point, then the waste must be safely stored for thousands, yes, thousands of years. The 1994 Minnesota legislature wrestled with these trade-offs as well. The 1994 law authorizing the casks also put the nuclear moratorium in place. Excuse me. The legislative findings from that law, I'm going to read verbatim since I want to be accurate. The legislature finds that there is great uncertainty over the means and costs of disposing of radioactive waste generated at nuclear power generating plants. Current and future electric ratepayers are at risk to pay for these uncertain and potential enormous costs. These costs could cause economic hardship for the citizens of the state and damage economic growth. For these reasons, the legislature finds it's necessary to protect its citizens against these costs. While these potential costs do not currently warrant closing an operating nuclear power plant, they do warrant a moratorium on nuclear plant construction and closer monitoring of operating nuclear power plants. And that was in Laws of Minnesota, 1994, Chapter 641. The issues raised in 1994 still ring true today. The trade-offs of the generation of additional nuclear waste relative to the risk to our community and the broader public should be carefully considered. Bearing this in mind, Prairie Island is opposed to lifting the nuclear moratorium without a viable solution for the waste. As we noted earlier, we understand the policy choices you are faced with, and we are well aware of the consequences of not taking any action. And consistent with our past practice, our tribe is always willing to engage in the discussion and to move on how to move Minnesota forward in energy conservation. Wolbita Tonka, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lato, and I hope you can stay around for questions from members. We have one more witness, Mr. Charles Sutton, if you could please come forward. Mr. Sutton, welcome back to the committee. I understand your testimony will be brief, concise, and to the point. And with that, please introduce yourself and fire away.
Chair Friends, members of the committee, Charles Sutton here on behalf of my clients, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 49, and the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. I want to thank the committee for their willingness to consider the question of the existing moratorium and discuss it in this hearing. Nuclear energy has provided a form of safe, reliable, and carbon-free energy for Minnesotans for over 50 years. It has also provided good-paying construction and maintenance jobs for our members. With the new 100% by 2040 law, it is more important than ever that we are taking a hard look at the existing nuclear moratorium. The electric sector today is poised for growth, with the coming increased electrification of home heating, appliances, and transportation, as well as new manufacturing and the need for data centers. There's going to be a growing need for firm, carbon-free electricity generation. Depending on the speed of electrification deployment, our state could move from a summer peaking to a winter peaking state. That means we will need energy available to meet evening and winter loads when Minnesotans turn up their thermostats and plug in their electric vehicles. This will be times when solar isn't available. New nuclear has the potential ability to meet that need. For those that are looking for an example of the ways that nuclear can successfully support decarbonization as well as good-paying jobs, I'd encourage you to look at sort of the history of the province of Ontario, Canada, as a model. Ontario currently gets 60% of its nuclear from energy from nuclear, along with 24% from hydro and 8% from wind and 1% from solar. So very little from carbon-emitting resources, but they face an energy crunch as well, with projected increases in demand from manufacturing and electrification, and they've actually decided to double down on nuclear. They've announced plans to build 4.8 gigawatts of new larger nuclear, along with a number of those small modular reactors as well at existing sites. These investments will not only ensure that electrification taking place actually reduces greenhouse gas emissions, but will create jobs for unionized construction craft workers. We're at a critical and challenging time in our state's energy future. Trying to decarbonize our existing electric load will be challenging enough, but doing so in the context of increased electrification will make it even harder. Nuclear energy can be an important part of the solution. We thank the committee for taking the opportunity to examine the moratorium and the potential for new nuclear energy to meet our state's clean energy goals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sutton, and thank you all the testifiers for your patience. Members, that's the end of our list of expected testifiers. Let's go to member questions, comments, observations. Again, informational hearing. The chair has a couple, but I'll go last. Members, Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a couple comments. I've been an advocate for nuclear energy and looking at these new technologies now for a couple of years, and I think the potential is there. And as we talked about the spent fuel. I think the potential is there to repurpose the spent fuel that sits at both Prairie Island and Monticello for these new technologies. And, I think that is something that would be beneficial to both of those communities to start actually removing the spent fuel rather than increasing what is there. So, and as we look as we're, you know, the discussions are out there on shutting down some of these fossil fuel facilities. And as Mr. Chair, you're well aware, the discussions around transmission that is out there, the ability to bring these small modular plants into where we currently generate with fossil fuels, transmission is already there and ready to get that right to the grid. So the potential is pretty positive, in my opinion. And again, I would recommend to any members who have not made the trip out to Idaho Falls, the National Nuclear Laboratories are already in the middle of doing some testing around small modular. The Department of Defense has done one test, and I know they've got a couple others that are going. It is some great background information to see where the technology is going, and I'm really excited to see this Terra Power as that may comes online out in Wyoming to show what some of the potentials are for the rest of the country. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Rarick. I share your enthusiasm that we take a closer look, that we're supposed to be open-minded to everything. We're supposed to be looking at different technologies, asking about reliability costs and any of the dangers. Are there any members of the public who wanted to testify that we didn't give a chance to? Seeing none. Further member questions or comments? Not seeing any. The chair does have a couple. Senator Matthews, I wondered about that. Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make a brief comment. I appreciate the discussion that we've had, even concerns raised that I believe we've tried to address. We will try to address as we move forward with this issue. And my only comment is, Mr. Chair, that we've been able to hold hearings on this, have passed bills out of this committee's under multiple energy chairs so far. We've had this is not my first informational hearing on the nuclear moratorium, and I'm looking forward, hopefully soon, to be able to act on this issue and start making progress on this. So thank you.
Well, Senator Matthews, as you know, we took it into conference on the advanced nuclear study last year. We're not able to hold it in. The conference committee process does allow either chamber to refuse. We'll see. Members, any further questions before we get ready to adjourn? I did want to ask Ms. Lato to come back up, if that's possible. Ms. Lato, just for a couple constructive, positive questions. First of all, thank you for taking the time here. One of our issues, of course, is siting, and I want you to know you have my pledge to not site any nuclear ever in my lifetime with my vote anywhere against the wishes of the neighbors and the people that live close by. So I wanted to get that on the record for you. Having said that, and having grown up 700 yards away, what advice do you have for the committee about nuclear? Where do you see that issue of storage going, and what would Prairie Island suggest to the Senate Energy Committee are the most important considerations if we're going to try to all live on the same planet, which we are, by the way, and that's not just this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. One thing that I truly appreciate your commitment on record to say that that you would not enforce nuclear on any community that wasn't suspecting it or didn't even want it. I think something that's really important to our community, because I'm not here to fight the scientific battle. I'm not here to speak on whether or not we think it's safe. What I am here to speak on, though, I will let our tribal council speak for us moving forward. However, what I did want to speak on personally and professionally, I have the experience of understanding that within our community, we are guided by what we call the Seven Generations Principle. It's a foundational principle that of our Dakota people, in which we have we contemplate how decisions that we make today will affect the next seven generations. And that's very important to our leadership. I'm a previous tribal council member, and it was important to have that in mind at all times, how my decision would impact future generations. And just thinking about this moratorium and the potential repeal, based on that principle and the radioactivity of nuclear waste, the decisions on the nuclear moratorium and repealing the nuclear moratorium will affect the next 400 generations. I always thought it was admirable that our tribe thought about the next seven generations, but your decisions toward the repeal would affect the next 400 generations. I think that one thing that is never taken into account is the fact that tribal members have this psychological effect that's hanging over them at all times. That's why I think it is, and I appreciate you saying that you wouldn't put this on next to any community that didn't want it, because no one's there at 3 o'clock in the morning when the alarms are going off and cars, you know, police cars are racing by and other cars are racing by, and tribal members are contacting me and saying, we hear weird sounds coming out of the plant and what's happening and blah, blah, and it goes on and on and on. We had recently an issue last summer where some of the noise, the nuclear power plant was making strange sounds and things were happening. And it was for 3 days the sounds kept going, and we were getting answers that it's not a big deal, this is standard, we had a small issue, but it's taken care of. However, our tribal members were posting on our Facebook pages, our social media pages, saying, we want to move. I wanted to bring my children back for the summer program. We're not coming back anymore. We're scared to death. Are we supposed to leave? Are we supposed to, you know, stay? What's going to happen to my family? What's going to happen to my homes? I think that's something that needs to be taken into consideration as well. You know, there's a lot of scientists that will come up here and say it's safe, but for our tribal members, having that looming over you at all times is something that needs to be considered, because it would be something that would have to be considered for other tribes or other communities. And the other thing I would think that's important to consider is that if you are going to lift the moratorium, that it is, anytime you do clean energy choices and you're going to support nuclear, that there should be a parallel. I would implore you to have a parallel discussion about what would happen with the nuclear waste. It's such an important topic, because no matter, even if you use SMRs or if you repurpose fuel, it still leaves a residual, it still leaves waste. And so I think that's something that needs to be considered, because Yucca Mountain was the promised land for everyone, and it was going to Yucca Mountain, but it's been since 1994, and that still has not come to fruition. So I would just ask you to take that into consideration. What's going to happen to the waste, and where is it going to go? Thank you.
Thank you for that, Ms. Lato. It was very helpful. Members, any final questions before we adjourn? All right, seeing none, thank you to all the testifiers. Thank you to the members of the public. Thank you for taking the time. With
thank
that,
you.
We are adjourned.